So thank the organizers for inviting me to speak. I'm going to tell you today about work. We've been doing work for a number of years, and this is all part of a wonderful collaboration that I've had with Sid Nagel since the last time I was here, which was the KITW workshop on jamming in 1997. And so ever since then, we've been working, and we've developed this jamming scenario. I'm going to briefly go through that, but mainly talk about what are the connections, some more tenuous than others, between jamming and the glass transition. So I'm going to tell you about work that's been done by Michael Schmiederberg, who's a postdoc just leaving my group now to go to Dusseldorf, and Tom Haxton, who's here, right there, who just defended his PhD last week. It's going to LBL. And Ning Xu, who is now assistant professor at USTC, who is a former postdoc with Sid and me. Okay, so, you know, since this session is a bridge between people who like to think about the glass transition and then people who like to think about glasses under mechanical load, just thought I would throw this up here. It's also a starting point for how I usually think about things. That, you know, you can think of the state of the system, whether it's glassy or, as we say, jammed or not jammed, in other words, fluid, in terms of a sort of phase diagram, and where you look at temperature, stress, and inverse density or packing fraction. So the idea is that at either a low temperature, for example, as you go through the glass transition, you lower the temperature at zero stress, this thing can be jammed, or you can jam it by unjam it by applying some load, like uniaxial tensile strain, as Mark was just talking about, or shear stress, or you could unjam it by lowering the density. Okay. And in this, and what's been obsessing us for a while is this, that there's a point here. Now, where this point actually is in density depends on your preparation, but if we're given preparation, it's sharp. And so the question is, and so the point here, and zero stress, if you're a low enough density, there's this unjammed state, the shear modulus is zero, and above it, it's jammed, the shear modulus is really non-zero, you have a glass. And this is a point that exists for a certain class of potentials. These are potentials that are spherically symmetric. They don't have to be spherically symmetric, but everything I'm going to talk about today is spherically symmetric. They're finite in range. So beyond a certain distance, which we can say is their diameter, they don't interact at all. But once they start overlapping, they repel. And the more they overlap, the more they repel. So for this class of potentials, there is this point, which is actually an unusual mixed first, second order phase transition, very much like the random RFOT. I'm blanking on what that stands for. Random first order transition. Okay, so so these are the kind of potentials that I'm talking about generally. And you can think of these as describing either a foam or emulsion or a frictionless granular material, or a simple system without any cohesion at zero temperature. Okay, so if you take these sort of systems and you generate packings and generate configurations, doesn't really matter how you do it. And now you look at local energy minima, so you quench into local energy minima or inherent structures of these things. You can look at what you've got. So these local energy minima, what you would get at zero temperature, right, so these are zero temperature configurations. And if you're a low enough density, none of them overlap. But if you're at high enough density, you have unavoidable overlaps. And so the pressure becomes non-zero, and the energy is non-zero. They start repelling each other. And this just shows the network of repulsive forces between the particles. And the point just is that the onset of overlap, just where they start, the packing fraction at which they just begin to overlap, is the same as the onset of jamming. Because once you get beyond the onset of overlap, you start developing a pressure. And what you see is you also develop a static shear modulus at exactly the same packing fraction. Another interesting feature of these systems is that the ratio of the shear modulus to the bulk modulus actually vanishes at the transition and with an unusual power. Okay, so this is the first thing, sign of something interesting going on at this transition. Okay, So just want to say that the onset of overlap has this very important first order character, that below the transition, there are no overlaps at all between any of the particles, but above, there are ZC contacts per particle. Okay, ZC overlapping neighbors per particle, and where ZC is non-zero. And in fact, Z goes to ZC at the same phi C, at the same place as you have the onset of a non-zero shear modulus, and that value of ZC is basically two times the dimensionality. Okay, so it's four in two dimensions and six in three dimensions. So where does that come from? And these are the ideas that Walter Kolb alluded to yesterday in the context of network glasses. He then asked if this would be interesting for spheres, and it turns out it's very interesting for spheres, because if you work it out for spheres, right, and you say, okay, how many constraints do I have? How many equations do I have that must be satisfied for the forces in the system? All the forces, the net force on each particle must balance out to be zero at zero temperature or at an energy minimum. So that's D equations per particle. And the number of forces that you have that must satisfy that is the number of interparticle interactions, overlaps, divided by 2. And so Z equals 2D is where these things are exactly equal. And so what that says is that at the onset of jamming, you have exactly the minimum number that you need for mechanical stability. So, and that's unusual. For crystals, you're usually well over the minimum, usually, not always, but usually well over the minimum that you need for mechanical stability for this system at the transition or right at the threshold. And that leads to very important consequences, okay? So the first one is that there must be a diverging length scale because this is a global condition. This condition is the average number of contacts over the whole system per particle must be exactly 2 times the dimensionality at the transition. That's a global condition. And what that translates into is a diverging length scale. And that argument was developed very nicely by Mathieu Viard, who's speaking in a couple talks from now. So the idea is the following. Suppose I take a system. Suppose I had a system just at the threshold, and now I cut a circle out, okay? Well, I cut all the bonds that were at the edges of the circle, and each cut bond is now taking me below the isostatic limit, and therefore it's going to introduce a zero frequency mode in the system. The system's not going to go unstable along one mode for each bond that's removed, okay? Now, suppose I'm well above the jamming transition, so there are lots of overlaps between the particles. So I have extra overlaps beyond what I need. Okay, but now imagine cutting this circle again. Well, how many soft modes will I have in this cluster? Well, I'm missing the bonds there at the surface. That's L to the D minus 1. But I have extra bonds in the bulk because I'm above the jamming transition. So I have Z minus ZC, where that's the extra number of contacts beyond the minimum that I needed, times L to the D, because that's in the bulk. And so if you say, what's the length scale at which I just start to see soft modes, okay, that length scale goes like 1 over Z minus ZC, so it diverges as I approach the jamming transition. Okay, so that's our diverging length scale. If I cut out a cluster that's too big, okay, bigger than this characteristic length scale, the system will look like an elastic solid. If it looks smaller than that, it'll have soft modes. Yeah. This one between here and here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can say it's empirical. We that's certainly consistent what we found numerically, and that's independent of the potential. There are also arguments for why that should be so. Okay. You're going to talk about it. Okay. All right. So what are the consequences of this diverging length scale? Well, one of the very interesting ones is for the vibrational properties. And so, you know, one of the things, the first thing you learn in a solid state physics class, right, is all solids are alike in their vibrational properties at low temperature or low frequency. And they all have, for example, the Debye law. And so the density of states always goes like omega to the D minus 1 in D dimensions. And, you know, characteristic properties of the heat capacity and so forth. And why is that? And that's because the long wavelength excitations are sound modes, and if you have a long wavelength excitation, you know, what you see is an effective elastic medium. And so no matter what kind of crystal you might have a polycrystalline system, doesn't really matter. At long length scales, everything looks elastic, okay? And so everything looks the same. But here, as I said, we have a diverging length scale. So that says that no matter how low in frequency I go, no matter how long my wavelength gets, I still don't see that effective medium. And that gives me very, very different vibrational properties. So what we discovered was that the density of states, in fact, develops a plateau at the jamming transition. The density of states should go like omega to the d minus 1, according to Debye. So it should go to 0, like omega squared in three dimensions. In this case, it actually is flat all the way down to zero frequency at the transition. Then as you compress above the transition, the system gradually realizes, oh yes, I'm a solid, I have to go to zero at zero frequency, but the frequency at which it starts to plunge away from this flat behavior increases as I compress above the jamming transition. So there's a characteristic frequency scale that increases as I compress the system above the jamming transition as a power law. Okay? Yeah. What? We get it numerically. The numerical diagnosis of the disordered system. Okay. So what this is saying, right, is that there's actually a totally new class of modes. Okay. These excess modes that are giving me this flat density states are not sound modes. Sound modes are constrained by the Debye law. You can't have that many of them. So these are new modes. These come from the fact that just at point J or just below this, you have all these soft modes just lurking there. And these then get shifted up, that's where all these excess modes come from. Okay, so that is the basic picture. And I'm not going to talk about it, I just want to put in an ad for this since Lisa Manning is talking next week, that we can actually use these vibrational modes, particularly the lowest frequency ones, which come from, as I said, the soft modes near the jamming transition, that are quasi-localized, and we can use these quasi-localized modes to actually predict soft spots, or STZs, or CRRs, from the properties of vibrational modes near the transition. Okay, so all right. So just to summarize, then, what I just said, right? You see that the coordination number jumps from zero below to some ZC, and then which is 2D, and then increases as a power law as I compress above the jamming transition. The ratio of the shear to bulk modulus has a power law, and there are two diverging length scales. One is the cutting length that I told you about. The other one is actually the one that Alexei Sokolov was talking about yesterday. It is defined by, for example, the transverse speed of sound divided by the boson peak frequency. So that characteristic frequency that I showed you that moves up as you compress, that is the boson peak frequency, and that's that length scale. Okay, so this combination of behavior, so you see a discontinuity and then these exponents, is very unusual. Most models don't show mixed phase transitions, right? And the really interesting thing, to my view, is that the models where you do see this sort of thing, are all models that have been proposed for the glass transition and that have glassy dynamics. So the models that, in fact, Jean-Philippe talked about yesterday. So the mode coupling approximation, the one-step replica symmetry breaking solutions are hard spheres or the p-spin interaction spin glass. These are in the mean field limit. These are all mean field models. These are mean field exponents. You see exactly the same behavior, the discontinuity plus those exponents, okay? And so that's interesting because I've just been talking about sphere packings and mechanical rigidity. I haven't been talking about glassy dynamics at all. And yet these models, which all do have glassy dynamics, show those same exponents and the discontinuity. So I think this is the first hint of maybe there's some quantitative connection between sphere packings and the glass transition. Okay, so now let's go to systems at non-zero temperature. Okay, So I'm going to ignore the shear stress axis in this talk. That's what Lisa's going to talk about next week. But here, what I want to do is approach the glass transition either by lowering the temperature or by increasing the density or pressure. Okay, there are different ways that you can approach it. And the question is, how do these models that I've been just showing you, how do they behave then in this region where I can equilibrate the system? Okay. And one of the questions, right, and this is motivated by these experimental results. This one you've seen many times, the angel plot. These are recent results for the colloidal glass transition, which show that, you know, there's this very rapid increase of the relaxation time as you approach some volume, high packing fractions in a colloidal glass. And one of the interesting things, which is sort of strange, is that they even have sort of the same functional form of the fits that are often used, that these are very, very fast divergences, much, much faster than Arrhenius, and even the same form is used. And so is there something to that? Why is that the case? Well, on the face of it, these two transitions have very different starting pictures, right? When we think of the colloidal glass transition, hard spheres, we think about free volume, and then the most important variable is pressure, because that tells you how much free volume you've got, okay? Whereas if I think about the glass transition, I have some very complex energy landscape, right? And temperature is the most important thing because it gets me over these energy barriers and allows me to get into other minima. So these seem to be very, very different ways of looking at the system. And I just want to show you that there is a limit in which these two transitions are really the same phenomenon. They're the same thing. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to just take a single potential for now, the harmonic repulsions, and we're going to take two trajectories, one where we fix the pressure and we lower the temperature. So that's a typical glass transition trajectory. And these are various trajectories. Different fixed pressures give me different results as I lower the temperature. Okay? Now I'm going to go this way where I fix now the temperature and I increase the pressure. And if I do that again, the relaxation time increases as I increase the pressure. Okay? Each curve here, each set of symbols is a different fixed temperature. So the point is that these are many different trajectories approaching in different directions, and we can come in from other directions as well. And they all collapse onto a single curve if you do the following. If you take time and scale it by the square root of pressure and temperature and scale that by pressure, then all of these data collapse onto a single curve. Okay, and why is that? So that turns out to be, you know, quite simple to understand. It's just dimension analysis. But it's not the way people generally do it. So we have three-dimensional parameters in our model, right? We have the interaction energy, epsilon. We have the particle mass. And we have the particle diameter, sigma. So you write the relaxation time in terms of these units. And it's a function of the temperature and pressure, right? But instead of making things dimensionless with the interaction energy, we can make them dimensionless with the pressure instead. So we could equally well write that the time scale times relaxation times the square root of pressure is a function of T over P and P over epsilon. And now you see where that scaling that we see comes from, is that if you now look in the limit where the pressure is low, because we're looking at trajectories not far from point J, that term basically drops out, and you end up with the relaxation time times the square root of P just being a function of the temperature over the pressure. And that's that collapse that I showed you. Okay? And here you see the relaxation time. As I increase the pressure, I drop away from this limit. But as the pressure goes to zero, I approach this limiting value. Okay? And each set of points here is a different value of T over P. Okay, so this just goes to a function of T over P, and that's the collapse. But now, you see, now we can say, well, that was just for a single potential, but actually, the point is that any potential that looks like a hard sphere potential in a limit where there's not much pressure should behave the same way. In other words, P over epsilon, P sigma cubed over epsilon going to zero, you can get that either by taking the low pressure limit, which is what we're doing, or you could take the hard sphere limit where epsilon goes to infinity. Same thing. And so we should see collapse of this for any value of alpha that's greater than or equal to zero, as long as there's not much overlap. And sure enough, right, everything does collapse onto a single curve along with hard spheres. So this is really just the hard sphere curve. Okay, so everything behaves like hard spheres at small overlaps. Seems a trivial statement, right? But there are two pieces of interesting physical insight that we can get out of this. The first thing is that this combination of T over P sigma cubed, what does that mean, right? What it says is, if you think about it, right, the ratio of T over P is a volume. And if we think about it, what we're saying is that thermal energy can do work against the pressure to open up free volume. Okay, and so what T over P sigma cubed quantifies is the amount of work that you can do against the pressure at a given temperature and pressure. Okay? All right, and the other point, right, that I want to make is that it's really essential to look at the dimensionless relaxation time, tau times the square root of P sigma over N. If you just looked at the relaxation time, of course you would not get this collapse, and that's why people had not noticed that before. All right, so now we know what are the important dimensionless variables, tau square root of P, T over P, P over epsilon. Okay, those are important control variables. But now we want to push this. Okay, we say, all right, fine, in the low pressure limit, everything looks like hard spheres, fine, you know, that's sort of obvious. But now what happens as I increase the pressure, and therefore I'm getting now a lot of overlap between my particles, okay? You clearly see that different kinds of symbols are different potentials here, and so the corrections that you get as you increase P, the pressure, okay, over the interaction energy, as you increase that, the corrections are different for different potentials. They all approach at sufficiently low pressures, they would all approach the hard sphere result, but if I'm not low enough pressure, my corrections depend on the potential. So what can we do about this? Oh, by the way, this shows that as the spheres soften, right, so as I go to P over epsilon bigger and bigger, the relaxation time, notice that the relaxation time is dropping, okay? That means that you know, if I had this rapid increase of the relaxation time as I increase the pressure for hard spheres, if I make them more deformable, that increase is not as rapid, and that's consistent with a recent paper by Mattson et al. In Nature, maybe a year ago. Okay, so, but what I want to show you now is that in addition to this temperature doing work against the pressure to open free volume now, once we have introduced pressure here, non-negligible pressures, there's a second mechanism of relaxation that becomes important. Okay, so the idea here is that if I have soft spheres and they have some diameter, but now they overlap, they act as hard spheres with a smaller effective diameter. Okay, of course you can always choose an effective diameter in a somewhat arbitrary way to get things right, but we don't want to choose it in an arbitrary way. So what we want to know is, how do we choose an effective diameter for these hard spheres? And you can see that if soft spheres with a diameter sigma behave like hard spheres with a smaller diameter, then these hard spheres will be at a smaller effective packing fraction, and they will have more free volume, so the relaxation time will speed up, right? But how do you choose this? Well, this is actually a question that was visited 40 years ago, okay, in the theory of liquids, to try to say, all right, if I have soft spheres, how can I choose an effective hard sphere diameter, not to get the relaxation time right, but in that time they were worried about the static structure and the thermodynamics, okay? So how do you choose it? And there's a particularly nice theory for this by Anderson, Weeks, and Chandler. So I know at least one person in the audience will like this. So the idea was to Taylor expand the free energy in the potential, you know, as a function, take a functional derivative, you know, Taylor expanded in the potential around the hard sphere potential, and then to choose the diameter of the hard sphere potential that you are expanding around so that the first order term vanishes, okay? So if you do that, you get a condition that looks like this, okay? Where this is your original soft sphere potential, this is your hard sphere effective potential with the hard sphere effective diameter, and this is the hard sphere cavity function, which is the paracorrelation function for the hard sphere system times the e to the beta v for the hard sphere system. Okay? Well, the point is that they're really good approximations for all of these things that are very well known now for hard spheres. Okay? So what you can do then is calculate the effective diameter simply from the potential. Okay, so for a given potential, you just feed it into here, you calculate a hard sphere, effective hard sphere diameter. And this works absolutely beautifully, as shown by Anderson, Weeks, and Chandler. This works absolutely beautifully to capture the thermodynamic properties, the pressure, the structure, G of R, all of these things for the soft sphere liquid. So it does really well with the static quantities. So what about the relaxation time? Okay. So let me remind you, we're going to start then with soft spheres at some arbitrary pressure or number density. Okay. We're going to use this Anderson, Chandler, Weeks approximation, and we're going to calculate this effective hard sphere diameter, sigma effective. That system will have a new packing fraction because it has a smaller diameter. Calculate that packing fraction. And plot our dimensionless relaxation time, where this is the relaxation time of our soft sphere system. This is the pressure of our soft sphere system. And this is the effective packing fraction of our hard sphere system. Okay? And what you see is that all the data that were all over the place that I showed you before, potential dependent corrections for higher pressures, they all collapse onto a single plot. And this gray curve here is the hard sphere result. Okay? So this is saying that we can collapse data for many pressures, and these are not small pressures. P over epsilon is equal to 0.1 corresponds to pressures of many tens of atmospheres for typical Leonard-Jones parameters for liquids. Okay, so these are not that small pressures, but it works just beautifully to collapse all of these things. So everything collapses onto the hard sphere curve. And remember what I showed you before, the hard sphere curve was not tau versus phi, not tau versus the packing fraction here, tau root p versus packing fraction, but tau root p versus temperature over pressure. But these two things are just related by the equation of state, and that's well known for hard spheres. So knowing phi effective, the packing fraction of my hard sphere system, I use the hard sphere equation of state. We can just use the Carnahan-Starling relation. Take that, and then take the relaxation time as a function of the effective T over P effective sigma effective. Okay, there you go. Collapses beautifully, and this is the hard sphere curve. The gray line is the hard sphere curve. So what is this saying? This is saying that the relaxation time of the soft sphere system times the pressure of the soft sphere system and the original diameter of the soft sphere is equal to the relaxation time of the effective hard sphere system, the new pressure, and the new diameter. Okay? So there's a very simple relation between these two. So that given the hard sphere master curve and the pair interaction potential, I can tell you the relaxation time of the soft sphere system, of any soft sphere system. Okay? So that's great for soft spheres, that's useful. Okay. What does it say? That says that actually hard spheres tell us everything we need to know about the soft sphere glass transition. Okay. Another nice thing about it, though, is that we can then use soft spheres to extend the master curve for hard spheres. Because we can take soft spheres at much higher pressures, so we can push the system to higher tau squared of p by increasing p at smaller tau, and so we can extend, actually, this curve well beyond where we can go for hard spheres. Actually, the hard spheres, monodisperse hard spheres, crystallize there, so we can carry it further. But for soft spheres, we could push it another couple decades. This was not huge effort, okay? Okay, so what does this say, right? As I said, there's the temperature opens a free volume against the pressure. That was the first thing, the T over P scaling, right? And one of the things I want you to take away is that hard spheres are really very fragile, okay? And I'm going to show you fits in a moment. to show that. There's really a very strong increase of relaxation time, highly supraarrhenius for hard spheres. The second thing is that the temperature allows soft spheres to overlap, or pressure makes them overlap, so that they behave like hard spheres with a smaller diameter. Okay? So it becomes less supraarrhenius, actually, with increasing overlap. And this is very different from the standard picture, because it's not saying that, you know, we've got in the energy landscape that we've got these minima that are getting deeper and deeper as we go to lower temperatures, or lower T over P, or so forth. What this is saying is that they're not becoming deeper, but they're becoming narrower and much more convoluted as we either increase the pressure or lower the temperature. So it's rather different from the standard picture. Okay, what does this have to do with point J, if anything? Okay, so I just want to say that point J is corresponds to this double limit of T over P, temperature over pressure going to zero, because it's at zero temperature, and pressure over epsilon going to zero, because it's the limit of zero overlap. Okay, so it's that double limit, and so if you take that double limit, remember the first limit where P over epsilon goes to zero gives me just a function of T over P, and now I want to know what is the limit of this function as T over P goes to zero. And of course, the question that everybody's been asking for, I don't know, at least a century, is does the relaxation time diverge when T over P is zero? Okay? Or does it diverge at a T over P that's not zero? Okay, is there a thermodynamic glass transition? If it's non-zero, there's a thermodynamic glass transition. If it's zero, that means it diverges at point J. And so we can do two fits. One is to the Volcker Fulcher. And David, you can't cut me off. This is the fit here. And what you see here is that both fits really work equally well. We cannot tell the difference. And of course, we cannot tell the difference, 14 orders of magnitude, 15, whatever, on from experimental data, it's hard to tell the difference, but certainly with our measly four decades, we can't say anything. So we can't say whether there is a thermodynamic glass transition or not from this, but the point is that if there isn't, okay, and you can believe what you will, I'm not going to try to convince you one way or the other. I happen to believe there isn't, but if there isn't, then that means that point J is controlling the glass transition. I believe there is not. Yeah. So that's basically what I want to tell you, that hard spheres really tell us everything we want to know about repulsive spheres. And I think the challenge that comes now is to include attractions. But that's actually not so bad. I mean, again, in the theory of liquids, there are nice techniques for handling attractions. And so that's what we're doing now. Thanks.
We're open for questions. Okay. So any of this?
I enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
And I could see the connections between granular jamming and network glasses. And I see the commonality that the point J is essentially the Maxwell isostatic transition, as we do in network glasses.
That's right.
The point of departure, the main point of departure that I see is as you go to the point J on the non-jammed region, when you reduce the packing, of course, in your picture, there is no more shear that the network can support.
Whereas there's no more network left.
Whereas in the network systems, we actually see glasses in the flexible region all the way to very low values of the mean coordination number. And very early in the talk, when you talked about the density of vibrational states, in that flexible region, as I'll describe on Friday, the main feature in the density of vibrational states are these floppy modes that Mike talked about.
That's right.
And the density of these floppy modes are very high in very flexible glasses. But as you approach the Maxwell rigidity transition, they actually come down.
That's right, they go away.
Yeah.
They're
and
lost
they
above
don't
that
go
transition.
Away completely. Mm-hmm. There's an exponential tail
yeah,
into the stress rigid.
That's right, they're always
so that, I think, is the main difference.
Right.
And it has big consequences on the point J. We don't see it to be a singular transition. We actually see two transitions there, a stress transition and a rigidity transition.
Yes.
And matter in this, between these two transitions, is very special. That's what I want to talk about.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And there are actually analogies for particle packings as well. So one example, for example, is you could take packings of ellipsoids instead of spheres. And then once you take packings of ellipsoids, it turns out that at the onset of jamming, the system is actually under constrained and you have zero frequency modes and so forth. So there's actually a broad region where you have zero frequency modes, which then go away once you compress high enough or you make them, you know, increase the ellipticity. So there are analogies even there. And so one of the points that we make is that spheres are very special, okay, and that the onset of jamming is really the same as the isostatic point. These two things coincide, and there are plenty of systems for which they don't coincide, okay? And then you might say, well, then spheres are special. Why worry about spheres? Well, it's a singular point, and like any good singular point, because it's singular, it actually controls the behavior for a wide class of systems. You know, so the fact that these coincide is actually quite important, is a very special and important feature of spheres. But it's true, there are quite a few systems for which that's not true. Yeah.
Ken?
Andrea, so the soft sphere collapse is very beautiful, but it reminds me of the recent simulation work of Berthier and Witten, and also our own theoretical work that I'll talk about on Thursday, for the repulsive particles where there's temperature and volume fraction. And they achieved a collapse onto two master curves, one above for soft spheres, one above the random close packing for hard spheres, and one below. Now, is there any connection? I mean, you have one collapse curve, and it would be, I think, the master curve below RCP of hard spheres. Is there any connection between your way of doing this collapse and what Berthier and Witten?
I suspect if they looked at the relaxation time, so what they did is they collapsed the equation of state.
Okay. No. But I'm speaking of their specific collapse of the relaxation time. The alpha relaxation time was collapsed on the master curves.
They were collapsed on the master
curves. They have a little bit
curves.
Of this effective hard sphere idea in there. And in addition, they have the idea that whether you're above or below jamming matters for hard spheres.
Right.
Is there a connection here?
Actually, I don't think so. I think they I mean so our collapses are really very different. In fact, we're taking data in the same range that they are. So even in many cases the same model. Yeah. So you know, we actually haven't gotten their data, but we should ask them for their data and do it. So, but I'm sure that everything will agree, right? It's just that they did that repulsive. We did that plus a bunch of others.
We got their data, and they say that they have two very different regimes, and they shared their data with us, and we were able to collapse it exactly as Andrea does. It looks somewhat peculiar. Their data looks the way they plotted it, because of the way they did it. They have a regime where if you're at low densities. If the density is low enough and you lower temperature, eventually you just get to something that's totally athermal, because the density is low and the particles aren't overlapping. And so basically where they say, at low density we have this athermal behavior. It's sort of a strange way of plotting the data. If you plot it the way Andrea does, it all collapses in that fashion.
So there aren't two branches, it's just one.
So are we.
Oh, well above. Yeah. We're going to very high pressures.
So the same, yeah.
That's right. They measured pressure as well, but they mostly talked about packing fraction. That's right. But they did something else where they collapsed the equation of state, and that collapse, I have a feeling, is the same as ours. And if they had tried to use that to collapse the relaxation time, I think they would have found the same thing. But they never used the scaled relaxation time.
Yeah, John Toner?
Yeah. What would happen when you described the Anderson-Weeks-Chandler formalism for determining this effective radius? It didn't look like there was anything that limited that to repulsive potentials. What would happen if you just did that with attractive potentials?
Yeah, right. So there are interesting things for attractive potentials. And actually, you know, I had learned something very important from David about that, which is that if you imagine, it's not only that the Anderson Weeks Chandler, you could apply that and get the effective radius for an attractive system, right? But this idea of temperature doing work against the pressure, it's a little bit different because if you open a cavity, you're also unbalancing the attractions. So that needs a little modification too, I think. So that's what we're trying now. No, we haven't. We don't have enough data yet.
So the formula that Andrea put up, I didn't want to embarrass you, but it was a typographical error.
Did I?
And if the formula was put up correctly, you would see that it's typographical.
It's e to the minus.
The should really be Boltzmann factors.
Yeah, it's e to the minus v of r, beta v of r, e to the minus beta v.
It's not potentials.
Sorry.
The Boltzmann factors. And so what you're doing is comparing something that looks like a Fermi function with, you know, a step function with a Smoot's Fermi function, and you're getting the area under them the same with this medium effect. And that's correct for repulsive cores. But if you put in attractions, there's the physics of unbalancing potentials, and that's not really contained in this. But there are ways to do that. So basically what happens is when you make a deformation that allows things to move, if it's a deformation that's on a length scale that's bigger than a couple of particles, if it involves 10 particles, there's an unbalancing potential, a little bit for each particle, but they multiply together, they add up together, and you can get a few KTs. And that'll change the reversible work to make that process happen, and that's so it slows it down. It's not perturbative. So you have to go back and you have to think about what that.
On your last point on connecting to finite temperatures and thermal fluctuation, wouldn't colloidal systems help there where you have these non-Brownian particles like Pine is studying, where you also have hard spheres and you can turn Brownian effects, thermal effects compared to shear and other forces? So wouldn't this system allow you to look on to your last question?
Which question was it?
whether point J rules the glass transition, because you also have a glass transition in these colloidal systems.
Oh, yeah.
You can tune the effect of Brownian motion by going to the non-Brownian particle limit.
But this whole question of, you know, is there a thermodynamic glass transition or not? I mean, even with colloids, you can still only get 5-6 orders of magnitude in dynamical range, and you know that's nothing compared to what you can get with supercooled liquids, where even 17 decades is not enough, right? So we're not going to answer that question anytime soon. Yeah.
This will be our last one before the coffee break.
So in terms of the connection between jamming and the glass transition, you know, there's been some work recently sort of trying to distinguish between the two. Not sort of severing the connection between them, but sort of seeing them as two steps in a process that leads to. Yes. Yeah. So is this something that? So now, if one does take this seriously, what happens to the phase diagram that you had? How do you think about that?
So, I think the phase diagram that we have is not what you want to answer a question like this. So what you need, I call this a jamming state diagram, but I'm sure I'm the only one who does that, but it helps me to think about it. So this is the way Jorge Kirchan likes to draw things, which is for me totally backwards, but he comes from spin glasses. So yeah, it's 1/1 packing fraction here and T over P here, right? And then here you come down as you cool the liquid or you increase the pressure of a hard sphere system, right? Then you fall out of equilibrium here and you end up at a point. Or you could cool more slowly and you would fall out of equilibrium here and then go down somewhere here. And then if you cool infinitely slowly, right, the question is there a thermodynamic glass transition? And then if you then took that, then you would end up at the ideal glass, right? And so, right, so the point is that, right, as he says, it's absolutely true, and this is something we know, there's a line of point J's, right? In other words, where the what I'm calling point J, where it is depends on how I prepared it. So there's a whole line of point J's here. And that's right, if there's a glass transition here, then that's controlling the slow dynamics, and this point is not, right? But suppose there's no glass transition, right, then you just come down here, and then it is controlled by one of these points, right? And so that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, so the point is, in making this distinction, the glass transition point is where the relaxation times diverge. And the jamming point is where the pressure diverges in the Hartsfield limit.
Right.
And so, especially since you're doing scaling with pressure in looking at the soft sphere systems, I want to know.
Right. I would say I can't tell whether this is true or this is true. I can't tell, right, whether there's a thermodynamic glass transition that's really distinct from the jamming transition or whether there's only the jamming transition. Okay.
So in your case, the relaxation times will diverge at the point where the pressure diverges.
No, we can't tell, right? We can take a form here, the Vogel-Fulcher form, right? I mean, we can't tell. This would say it diverges at where the temperature over pressure is 0.05. Okay, and that works just as well to describe the data, you know, that we have as the Elmitad-Chandler-Garahan form. Now, you may like their form better because it collapses so much data over such a, you know, wide range. So there are other reasons for liking that. But from just fitting this master curve alone, you can't say, okay, they work equally well. So we can't say anything about that. You know, I happen to like to think about the other thing, but that's just me.
Thank you very much.